Lasso. So I'd like to give a brief introduction for this session, go right in, and then I have a lot of mail to respond to. This afternoon we'll go to the third of the three marks of existence, and as I mentioned yesterday, rather elaborated yesterday, insofar as we really integrate insight into any one or all three of these marks of existence, it really does create quite a revolution, a radical transformation in one's whole way of engaging with reality, one's whole life. So it's quite a big deal. So you recall the first one was all composite phenomena are impermanent. Simple statement, so easy to remember and believe. And then just sits out there like something inert. And then all contaminated, let's say, experiences are unsatisfying. And again, very just now, a real brief, just the nutshell of that is that whenever we look to any appearance, including mental appearances, self-images and so forth, reputation, one's accomplishments and so forth, whatever it may be, any appearances. And one attends to an appearance, and it could be of another person, a home you'd like to buy, an occupation, anything at all. You look to it and you think, ah, this will provide me with happiness. This is it. This is going to do it. That's dukkha. That's dungarwa. That's going to be unsatisfying. Just because you're looking in the wrong place. And then we can say, oh, you mean to look within. Yeah, but what does that mean? And that is, for example, artists often, especially 20th century artists, you know, often, I want to express myself. I want to express my creativity, my uniqueness. I saw an artist once, he had kind of a tank, and there was a suspended basketball right in the middle. And then he started to elaborate about, this is the meaning of, and I just said, give me a break. It's a basketball in a fish tank. But okay, all right, I'm not much of, don't have a whole lot of appreciation for that kind of art, neither the fish tank nor the basketball, you know. But so there is that realm, and I don't ridicule it as, oh, isn't that silly, but I do say, if that's where you're looking for genuine happiness, you're looking in the wrong place too. My creativity, my artistic, So no, not deep enough. Not deep enough. Look deeper than that. So if one is looking even there and you're looking for something truly satisfying that will respond to your deepest desire, that prime directive, the deepest motivation for finding genuine happiness, it will be unsatisfying. And then once you've cleaned all those off and say, okay, wrong place, then you can either be falling into despair and depression, or you can find, and now where do you look? And then you practice Dharma. And of course, that's looking within, but it's finding out what does that mean, look within. So shamatha vipassana might be a good trajectory. So now this afternoon, and briefly, I think we don't need a lot of words, the third mark of existence. And this is chū tamshī tōngjīng dāgmēbā. Chū tamshī tōngjīng dāgmēbā. All phenomena. Now, not only all conditioned phenomena, not only all contaminated phenomena, or contaminated, you know, experiences contaminated by mental affliction, but everything, all phenomena, are empty and not self, or devoid of self. Okay, that is, if you look for them, if you look at anything, whatever, brain, kneecaps, liver, heart, body, mental states, and so forth and so on, you'll see they're empty, empty of anything that belongs to the self. That is, there's nothing in them that suggests they have some intrinsic ownership. They're empty of ownership. And if you're looking for them, is that I? Is that I? Is that me? Is that a person? Some intrinsic entity, some real inherently existent self, ego, individual. No. So all phenomena, empty and not self. Not self. Absent of self. So, now of course, does this mean we don't exist at all and this cell phone doesn't actually belong to me? Yes, actually it does, and it stops belonging to me as soon as I say, okay, Miles, you can have it. And I'm not saying that. Right? So there it is. But so sure. So do I exist? Sure, there's somebody talking, and if you want to know his name, I think you got that one figured out. But the question here is there some inherently existent entity that stands apart from, has its own something like an autonomy, that is in control of the body and mind, and in some very meaningful, real way, that is something you can actually observe that's real, actually does own, possesses, and therefore to some extent controls. So that's exactly what is said to be empty of or not self. My emotions are not a person. My personal history is not a person. Thoughts and so forth and so on. The brain is not a person and so forth. Or I heard one neuroscientist say, every one of the 900 billion neurons in the brain, each one knows where it is. I beg to differ. I don't think so. I don't think there are 9 billion sentient beings inside my brain. I don't think so. Superstition. So, but then let's make it interesting, because you probably heard everything I've just said and probably makes sense. So then you believe it. Big deal. But now where does it get interesting? Right? And so it's quite clear. If I just say, okay, Anilak belongs to you. Oh, sure, I can use the cell phone. Thank you. There it is. It no longer belongs to me. Or somebody steals it from me. And then I just have no control over it, and I have no way of retrieving it. Then I can, if I wish, if I want to make myself unhappy, I will think somebody out there has my cell phone. And I can just be unhappy indefinitely. He has my cell phone. And the other person who stole it just says, I don't have your cell phone. I have my cell phone. You're mistaken. I'm entirely in charge of the cell phone. You don't even know where your cell phone is. You're mistaken. I'm right. Tough luck, you know. So a little bit of disagreement there. So quite interesting about that. All right, but clearly we can release. All right, it's stolen. I think probably all, have you not all had something stolen from you sometime? I have. And that, at some point you have to say, you know, that doesn't belong to me anymore. It used to, and now it doesn't. And then you can relax. And all you've done is you've retracted a conceptual designation. Right? That's all it is. So, but where it gets interesting, we'll go right to the meditation, is for something like a cell phone, or here's something really lightweight. Does everybody know where my room is? My room, 2327, it's my, I stay there every time, I never stay in anybody else's room. I only stay in my room. Right? I don't even pay for it. They give me a free room here. Right? So exactly why is that mine? Well, you know why. Just because they said, Alan, you can stay here. It looks good to me. It's nice to have a suite, so I meet with people not in my bedroom. It's more appropriate. There it is. Very simple. It's courtesy. It's convention. You know? But there it is. But we can see how lightweight that is. Really lightweight. But is it correct for me to say that's, oh yeah, where's my room? My room's right over there in the corner. Like, yeah, it is. But we see how lightweight it is. And so let's say that's one of the lightest weight places. Or I'm the chairman of this place. Chairman Al, they call me. Chairman Al of the Mind Center. Right? Okay. I think, shouldn't I be able to say this is my Mind Center then? I mean, I get no salary. I didn't pay for it. I have almost no authority at all, any kind. But I'm chairman. Chairman Al. So shall we agree this is my mind center? I mean, I can't even rent out one room. But shall we say that? Why not? I mean, I'm chairman. Right? Is Andrea here? I don't think he's Andrea here. Good. Uh-oh. We may have some disagreement. Because he actually is the meditation resident teacher, and I'm not even that. So he and I might have to box. All right, so we're dealing with the lightest weight. I mean, the lightest possible weight. Does it get any lighter than that? I'm not sure how it could be lighter than that for me to say this is my mind center. But in some conventional sense, well, why not? You know. But now consider that. And then as we're about to go into the meditation, then we attend to this body-mind complex, okay? Knowing that I can easily give up that room if they say, Alan, would you believe, we'd like to have Chitra and Jerry move over to the other side for whatever reason best known to them. We'd like for you to swap. You over there. Okay, whatever. Then that's no longer my room. It's that easy. All they have to do is say, you can't stay here anymore, and then it's not mine. All right, that's very, very simple. This giving that away is something simple. But when it comes to what is called Nyewar Lembe Pumbo, and these are the closely held skandhas, and that's a very, very direct, closely held, closely taken, closely grasped skandhas, and in short, simply, my body, my body, my mind. When I think of my hand, I think of this as something a little bit more serious than that. Now, we had a certain person here in the CV teacher training just a couple of weeks ago. He left a little bit early because his father had some very serious liver problem. It might have been cancer, I don't know. And the son flew up to Korea to give his father part of his liver. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now, there's a son devoted to his father. So he's going to be in the hospital for a while. So to save his father's life. So that's a pretty intimate organ. I mean, that's nobody else could claim that that's their liver. I mean, that's not negotiable. But he's giving away part of his liver. And then his father would say, okay, that's thank you. That's now my liver. Enough to live on, right? So, but that's getting a bit more intimate, isn't it? Rather than giving a cell phone, giving away part of your liver. So we see it's getting now a bit more serious. This is pretty trivial. This is my center. That's very trivial. But when it gets to body parts, that's pretty up close and personal. And the fact that, and then we see that it's not only a body, but there is, that's mildly uncomfortable. So there's a little bit of discomfort. So dukkha, a little bit, a tiny bit of dukkha, as I stick my fingernail into my skin and feeling that's my discomfort or my dukkha, my physical pain. Very slight, but there it is. That seems to be a bit more serious than my cell phone. So my body, my feelings, and then my mental processes, my thoughts, my memories, and my desires, my sense of personal history, my anticipations of my future, and then, very powerfully, my emotions and my feelings, happy, sad, indifferent, my consciousness, and so forth, my attention. Now it seems like there's something that's got some real muscle in there, doesn't it? Like something we have to take more seriously. And then we can ask, this is where we go into meditation. We stop talking, we start looking carefully. Is there some sharp divide, like reality comes down with a guillotine? And then on this side of the guillotine, mine and not mine, just convention, the cell phone. And on this side of the divide, oh no, this is serious. This is really mine. I mean, it just is. I mean, it's not negotiable. It's not conventional. It's just real. Is there such a divide? Watch closely. Watch closely. One interesting example here, I think, is especially salient with mothers, but it's not confined to mothers. But imagine a mother who's with a small child, like a 3-year-old child, maybe your only child, right? And imagine the mother witnessing your child being injured. I don't want to give an example, just that. You can imagine, but imagine, so mothers, I know there are another number of mothers here, but imagine watching your child be injured and then crying loudly because it really hurts. It's not just a mental, is it? It's not just mental. I'm looking at a mother, I know, what, 3 children, yeah? Four. But I know there are other mothers here as well, of course. But it's not, my sense is, because I have something, not even close to being a mother, but I care about people, but it's not just, oh, I'm sorry for you. It's something closer, it's something deeper, isn't it? We actually, if you look at a mother's face when she sees her child being harmed, it could very easily, if you didn't see the child, it could very easily be interpreted as, oh, are you in pain? Because like that, as if somebody has just, you know, pierced her. If the child's been pierced, you could look at her and say, like, have you been pierced? What's wrong? Are you injured? No, over there. So, identification, my child, right? So that's powerful. It's powerful, and it's entirely, obviously, outside of your own body. So that would be suggesting, well, okay, it's not inside my skin, but boy, is it a lot more intimate than seeing somebody step on and crack my cell phone. That would be, oh, bummer. You know, but I wouldn't like it, but I wouldn't feel it in my guts. I wouldn't feel it inside my skin. If somebody just, you know, crushes my cell phone, yeah, get a new cell phone, big deal, you know? So where's the gradient? Examine the gradient. We know conventionally speaking, yes, that's existent, that is the ownership, as I said yesterday. The ownership exists, sure, it's a convention. But is there something beyond that? When we look at things as being I or mine, is there something beyond the conventional? So let's take one more example, then we'll jump in. When I hear a bird song, I'm outside and hear some bird singing. Who thinks, oh, that's my sound? I don't think anybody thinks that's mine. Maybe the bird does, but a human being hearing a bird song, you don't think, that's my sound. I don't think so. Even if you're the only person, even if the bird is deaf, and you're the only sentient being on the planet who heard it, you would say, well, okay, the bird is deaf, tough luck on the bird, and I'm the only one, but that still doesn't make it mine. Just because I had a unique viewing, nobody else heard that bird except for me, that still doesn't make it your sound. It was just that you alone perceived it, right? And so likewise, from your vantage point, nobody in the universe has your vantage point visually. If you turn your head and look around, nobody is seeing your cinema, right? Because you have a unique perspective. So now do you think, oh, those colors are mine because I alone have this perspective? I don't think anybody thinks that. So sounds, and then if you just pick up a fragrance, do you really think it's your smell? If you do, probably should take a bath. But if it smells other than your own body, you don't think, oh, that's my fish, you know, when you're over coming towards the kitchen, or that's my cinnamon or anything like that. It's just a smell, even if I'm the only one to smell it. It's just still a smell. And likewise, when you put something, you know, some food in your mouth, you don't think, oh, that's my sweet, or that's my bitter or sour or what have you. It's just, okay, nope, it's quite true. Nobody else has their tongue in my mouth. I uniquely am tasting this food, but it doesn't mean it's my tastes. It just happens to be in my mouth, unique view. So you see where we're going. Then you direct your attention to your mind. Now, quite clearly, unless somebody's, eavesdropping by way of their clairvoyance, apart from that, you have a unique perspective. Nobody else is seeing those thoughts, those memories, those images, those dreams, and so forth. Yes, you do. Yes, you have a unique perspective. Now, does that make them yours? And if you think so, why? Yes, nobody experiences your feelings, your tactile sensations, your feelings of pleasure, pain, or your sadness, or your happiness, or your sense of glee, or what have you. Nobody else. But just the sheer fact that you're experiencing it, does that make it yours? And does it make it yours for any other reason than that you identify with it? So the mother, a woman, might look at another child being injured and feel very sad. Oh, I'm sorry the child is harmed. I hope he gets good treatment quickly. And if it's her child, then she'll feel in her body, it will be like a shock to her system, right? My child, not my child, right? So there it is, the Buddhist term, now we end. The Buddhist term is for this body-mind system. These are closely held. And they're closely held with the tentacles, the tethers, the bonds of I and mine. I and mine. Right? So are those tethers, that closely held grasping, is that built into the object? In other words, is it inevitable? Is it just something that's just the way it is? Right? For example, when I show the face of my cell phone, it's just pretty much black, right? You have no choice. You can't alter that. It's just, there it is. That's its color. You might like it to be lavender or pink or chartreuse, but so sorry, that's it. That's all you get. It's the black cell phone, right? There's no malleability there. Is the minus, the ownership, is it just thrust upon you? We have no choice. It's just, there it is. Own it. You have to. Just like you have to see black if you're looking in this direction. You have no choice. Is it like that? Something objectively presented where you've just got zero choice. All you can do is close your eyes, which is like anesthesia. But if you open up, there it is, black all over again. Is ownership like that? Your ownership of your thoughts, your memories, your emotions, desires, and all of that, is that thrust upon you? Is it inevitable if you are paying attention? Or is there some malleability there? Could you withdraw the tentacles? As we clearly can. If you own stuff but don't have attachment to it, you really don't have to suffer. If your stuff, your stuff is damaged, you think, well, it's just a convention anyway. And so, you really don't have to suffer at all if you release your identification. Your serious identification with the stuff you own. So it comes, it goes. The body comes and goes. You don't have to suffer if you just release the tentacles of identification, of taking seriously I and mine, seeing it as anything other than conventional. So we turn to then the third mark of existence. Not whether anything is I or mine, because yeah, there's a person here and it's me, and this is my hair and this is my cell phone. Yep, I'm not going to debate that. It's not interesting. But what does it mean? And is there a demarcation beyond the merely conventional, where it gets actually real? That's what we closely apply mindfulness to. Sound interesting? Okay, at least for 24 minutes. Okay. Let's go in. So much of the answer to so many of the questions raised in the Vipassana with respect to impermanent suffering, non-self, so much of this is found in the entry, that sense of release, of letting go. Releasing grasping, setting your body and mind at ease. So settle your body in its natural state, your respiration in its natural rhythm, and for a little while, settle and balance your mind by way of mindfulness of breathing. We'll get to the mind later, but this week is for the close application of mindfulness to the physical, with a primary emphasis on our own bodies. But embracing now our sensory access to the physical by way of the five physical senses, direct your mindfulness now with eyes open to the visual field. With discerning mindfulness, without conflating your conceptual projections upon upon the perceptually given. In other words, as the Buddha counseled, in the seen, let there be just the seen. Within this visual domain of shapes and colors, do you perceive anything that appears to you as you or yours, that really from its own side, by its nature, really belongs to you? Or are they simply shapes and colors and nothing more? Close the eyes. Direct your mindfulness now single-pointedly to the domain of sound. In the heard, let there be just the heard. And as you closely apply mindfulness to this domain of experience, pose the same question. Does anything here appear to be I or mine? And if so, why? Now come in with it, come within this domain of body-mind system. which is normally closely held with the bonds of I and mine. Single-pointedly focus your mindfulness on the space of the body and whatever tactile events arise within that domain. Again, to the best of your ability, release all imagery, all mental activity here, projections, designations, labels, constructs. Let it be purely tactile. In other words, in the felt, let it be just the felt. To be sure, this may indeed be a private showing. It may very well be true that you are the only person that experiences this array of appearances arising. Now, with respect to these sensations correlated with earth, water, fire, air, do you apprehend any of these as being truly, by their very nature, yours, beyond mere convention, truly, really, yours? Is it simply a matter of control? That over which you have control is yours because you can control it. Is it that simple? How much control do you have, really, over these sensations arising from moment to moment within the domain of your body? when it comes to outer objects, possessions such as cell phones and so on, we can extend and we can retract the tentacles of mine. We can give it away, we can sell it, we can simply stop thinking, that's mine. Is there any malleability here? In terms of the extent to which we feel these sensations are mine. To what extent can we simply be aware of them? Sensations arising in space with no intrinsic ownership, simply arising independent upon causes and conditions. Substantial causes and cooperative conditions arising and passing, rising and passing. With none of those causes or conditions being a self, a person, an ego. Is that true or not? Closely examine the phenomena arising within the space of the body, this tactile field. Now, with your eyes at least partially open, let your awareness illuminate all five sensory domains of experience. And as you closely apply mindfulness to these five domains, observe carefully. Are any of these appearances more or less yours, let alone you? And if so, why? Hola, so quite a few questions. I think they're, I've glanced at them. They tend to be quite practical, so let's jump right in. So when I focus on my breathing, it automatically becomes uneasy and tight. And when using the out-breath to relax deeper, it feels as if I'm interfering with the natural flow. If you start meditation using phase two, abdomen, can you change to phase... Okay, that's the first one. Not a whole lot to say, except for learn how to relax. And that is when you breathe. Again, use whatever image you like a balloon, where you just open up the balloon and all the air just goes like that. You don't have to squeeze it. It really will come out, you know, and you just let it come out. Or the jug with the opening the faucet, it just flows out. So when you breathe out, just do less. Do nothing. And at some point, you'd have to actually do something to prevent the breath from flowing in. And don't do that. Don't do anything to prevent the breath from flowing in. Let it flow in. It's good for you. Not a whole lot I can say, except for just practice more. Practice more. Okay. It becomes uneasy and tight. You know, in a way, this, I mean, it's a perfectly good question. It's a perfectly good question. And what you're discovering is this is the tension you're carrying in your body all the time. And it's not so obvious when you're always focusing on things around you and things you have to do and your mind perpetually caught up in rumination. So welcome to your body. It may not be a very pleasant neighborhood to be hanging out in. But the easiest entry to this, because you need something practical, the easiest entry is the out-breath, okay? And that is just that. Without forcing it out, without holding it back in, it's a whole bunch of not doing. Just don't do anything at all. Just... Like a balloon, you just open the end of it. But breathing through the nose. So, again, the image, breathe as if you're deep asleep, and yet mindfully so. And then we can talk about it when you come in personal, we can talk about it again. But mostly it's just kind of getting the hang of it, just keep on going back to it. If you start meditation using phase two, focusing on the abdomen, can you change to phase three, that is nostrils, during that session, or vice versa, or is it best to stick to one throughout the whole meditation? You can definitely shift. You can definitely shift. If at any time when you're focusing on the nostrils, if you start feeling some tension coming in, some tightness, then just immediately drop down. Just come right down here, right? Because that's just one thing. You want to nip in the bud, we say. Just don't let any habit arise of starting to get tight around the eyes, the forehead, the eyebrows, the muscles around the eyes. If your face can be like that of a baby, just soft and loose, like a sleeping baby, that's good. If there's no contraction, this is good. If it gets sometimes so subtle that you're just losing it, you're getting a bit frustrated, then come back to abdominal. It's bound a bit easier, be a bit easier. So, but on the other hand, if when you're focusing on the abdomen, if it gets just a little bit kind of like boring, like, okay, is this all there is to it? You may be developing relaxation stability, but you have not yet added clarity. And I can guarantee you, insofar as clarity comes in, nothing's boring. Nothing's boring. I think I gave you the example of years ago, it's probably 35 years ago. I had people just, when they're really kind of in a bit of samadhi, a bit, you know, well-focused, just extending and bending their finger, one finger. I said, do it really slowly. And do it in little increments. Move and then pause. Move and then pause. Move, pause. Oh, people did that for a whole hour. Whoa. Yeah. It can actually be quite interesting. I mean, what's the nature of movement? What's the nature of stillness? How still is still? How is it that I made it move? That's kind of be quite interesting. But if and only if you're clear. Otherwise... So wherever there's clarity, there'll be... So if this gets a bit boring, then come up here and tend to the subtler sensations, arouse greater vividness of attention, and the breathing is not boring. Minds are boring. Appearances aren't. It's difficult for me to feeling the tactile sensation of my breath in the upper lip. For doing that, I tend to force the breathing, and then I can feel it. However, as soon as my breath relaxes, I lose it again. What do you recommend? Very good. What I recommend is come back to the abdomen. Come back to the abdomen. And if that's too subtle, put on some weight. No. But this probably won't be too subtle, okay? Especially if you have a belly like mine, it's really easy. And so, but come back to where you can really, kind of like, you know how gears mesh and then they turn together, of course? So get to the point where the sensations of the breath mesh with, that is, you can be really engaged with, like two hands holding. And then I turn my right hand and the left hand has to turn. So let your attention engage with the ongoing flow of sensations of the breath. So you really are, this is a nice word, engaged, right? And so there it is, abdomen expanding, releasing, expanding, retracting, and so forth. And then when you get into the flow of that, the rumination is calming down. And also right there at the abdomen, of course, when your whole system does settle down, even there too, as your body needs less oxygen, the volume of the breath will decrease, in which case even the sensations of the breath at the abdomen will get subtler. Right? I mean, if you've just been jogging, and you go, and I don't need to mimic it, but you know, you're really panting, you're heaving, well, the sensations are really, really obvious. Right, of course. So you're breathing deeply. When the breath gets subtler, these sensations will get subtler. So if you can track that and still remain engaged, then come up here. But what I suggest is don't force the breath. Then you're just basically, you're not doing the practice anymore. Now you're just forcing the breath. That's not mindfulness of breathing. Okay? So don't force the breath. If it's too subtle here, come here. If that's too subtle, okay. Can you feel your body breathing anywhere at all? Or do you think you might be dead? And I think you'll figure that one out. Hola. To the next one. Can you elaborate on the meaning of non... that's one I dealt with. Very good. From Martin. Oops. So let's see if there was anything more there. I want to make sure that I don't skip. There seems to be a continuum, at least in the way non-conceptual is used. Isn't any position conceptual? So I think I've responded to that, and you're exactly right. It is a smooth spectrum from being totally caught up in conceptualization. In fact, I haven't introduced this, but it's very useful. And I encountered this years ago. Three terms. I'll give you the Sanskrit. Kalpana, or for Andrea, dopa. That's simply conceptualizing, thinking. And we know that can be very useful. When we're remembering things in the past that we need to remember, where did I put my glasses, or whatever, that's dopa. All memory is by way of conceptualization. You can't remember without activating conceptual mind. Okay? And so, but whether you're remembering, whether you're anticipating, where shall I go for a walk this afternoon, or what have you, this is dopa. And dopa can be very useful in so many areas, no question. Okay? Especially when you pick it up and put it down when you're finished. All right, and then there's the Sanskrit term is vikalpa, or namdo. And this is what we call rumination. Or the underlying problem is obsessive compulsive delusional disorder. So the thoughts are flowing obsessively, compulsively you're drawn into them, and then very often we delusionally think that whatever we're thinking is the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Right? So that's a problem. And it's been studied scientifically, psychologically, contemplatively, and that's really a malfunctioning mind. But even there, you can get some things right. I mean, when you're ruminating, not everything you think is completely false. Right? And you may be ruminating about some aspect of reality in which you are engaging with something real, right? Clear. Although you may be getting involved in speculation and anxiety and so forth and so on. And then there's the term parikalpata, or yongsutopa. Parikalpata is where the rumination is going, that is the ongoing flow of obsessive compulsive conceptualization is taking place, but it's gone into liftoff. It's no longer engaging with reality at all. It's just, so people who are schizophrenic, and I've had close encounters, three schizophrenics, long time ago, when I was living in Dr. Ishidrin's home, and it's because I was there as kind of the interpreter and so forth, three people came into my life who were really full-blown schizophrenic. So I had a tiny bit. Of course, I had no professional training whatsoever, not then or now, but I had a very close glimpse, three times over about a year or so, of, it happened to be women, who are full-blown schizophrenics. And so the way they would talk and what for them was reality was just had nothing to do with anything that was intersubjective. So one, there was a devil inside of her. Nobody else was perceiving that devil. And then the talk goes on and so forth. So clearly, hallucination, very, very tragic, cognitive hyperactivity to an extreme degree. So that would be an extreme degree of this yongsu dopa, or this complete, how do you say, just totally unrealistic conceptualization, where you've gone on and you're no longer really in dialogue with reality. You've gone into your own, like an airplane that's been shot down, it's going into a tailspin. It's just out of touch, okay? Well, we see that in schizophrenia. We find that in other types of psychosis. But on occasion, too, then in the psychology, they call this a refractory period, right? Where something's happened, and you're responding to it, and then the mind just starts going into a spin of speculation, and you're actually taking that speculation very seriously, and it's completely unhidden from reality. You know, it's like one of those movies that we say, this is inspired by real events. Yeah, something happened in the 18th century, and that was a real event. Something did actually happen. There was Europe in the 18th century. And that's the basis. And then we go off and, you know, all right, you can say, well, okay, 99% of that movie was parikalpita, complete fiction. Okay, well, if they say, there it is. It's entertainment after all. But it's a problem if you start taking something that's entirely complete fiction and then thinking, oh, that's what took place in the 18th century. Now you're flat out delusional. So to observe the kind of thinking that comes up, some of it constructive, deliberate, or it could be creative, free flow, daydreaming, but consciously so. It's not to say that all of our thoughts should be regimented. No, we don't want that to be uptight. But if all of our thoughts are lucid, I don't see any downside to that. Any more than I see a downside to all of your dreams being lucid. Because I don't see any upside to being delusional. Ignorance is not bliss, and delusion certainly isn't. Right? So those three, thinking, then rumination, and then what should we call the third one? I've never really given it a translation. But totally unrealistic rumination. You know, it just lift off. So there once again we have a spectrum, you know, and all of that is conceptualization from very, very useful. Einstein coming up with general relativity theory, that with dopa, kalpana, very useful, brilliant. And then the psychotic who's just in a rampage of misery, all self-created. Okay? Hola, so moving on. Now that we're working hard on the path of shamatha. You work hard. I just want to enjoy it. But now that working hard in the path of shamatha, it would be nice to know the statistics of this century. Yes, it would. Now, since we can't know that, the next question is, how many people that you know of has achieved it? I think that's kind of irrelevant, frankly, because how many people do I know who have one green eye and one brown eye? Why are you asking? How would I know? I mean, I don't know most of the 7 billion people on the planet. So it doesn't really matter that much. I know so few people. And I've been to Tibet 4 times, but what's the percentage of even the yogis there that I've met? Tiny, so therefore insignificant. So if I were to do a poll, it would be thrown out by every scientist and say, that's not a scientific poll, you don't know. So the answer is, we don't really know. Generally speaking, because the first time I went to Tibet, 20 years ago exactly, I went there with a very specific aim to try to do something very preliminary, superficial, and inconclusive, but try to get some sense in Tibet in 1992, in eastern Tibet, northeastern Tibet, central and western, because I got to all four areas, is anybody practicing and achieving shamatha any longer in Tibet after all those years of Chinese domination, Chinese communist domination and suppression and genocide? And I also interviewed people in Beijing, in Chengdu. And the answer was that few, but not non-existent. Few, but not non-existent. Yeah. And for a wide variety of reasons. There in Tibet, it's obvious. It was genocide, for heaven's sakes. They killed almost everybody, or so many people, and destroyed almost all the monasteries and hermitages. Right. But in addition to that, it's more complex than that, because in Nepal, they've not had any genocide. In Ladakh, in Bhutan, Sikkim, no genocide there. But the truth of it, and I just recently had this confirmed again from His Holiness. I mean, he certainly, if you wanted to ask somebody who could actually maybe give a really good answer, it would be he and not I. His view is so much greater, broader, inclusive than mine. But it does seem to be the case, generally speaking, and this is true largely in Southeast Asia as well. I've lived in Sri Lanka as a monk. I was there for about 6 months and spent a good deal of time here now. Never been to Burma, but it's in the pipeline, so I hear things. And it's relatively few people. that, number one, have a really good understanding of shamatha. Anybody can say samatha, but that doesn't mean you really understand it, let alone what it actually means to achieve access to the first jhana. A lot of people are very confused on that, or very, very, very superficial and utterly misleading understanding. So just for starters, do you understand it clearly, and what it means to have attained it, and what are the indications of that? Not that many people have that, and a lot of people don't know anything about it, and a lot of others know only enough to be confused about it. So that's a major issue. And do you know how to practice authentically? Do you have an authentic teacher? So they're not many. And then people who, among the wide variety, this is within Buddhism, now we're setting aside Hinduism, but within Buddhism, then in the Zen tradition, almost non-existent. I've spoken with some very knowledgeable Zen people. They have marvelous yogis there. There are still some. But within Zen tradition, the very notion of practicing shamatha as a discrete discipline, almost non-existent. Almost non-existent. Almost nobody. They're doing soto. They're just sitting. They're doing with it, working in rinzai with a koan, but actually saying, okay, now let's set out and achieve access to the first jhana. You might not find anybody. In Korean Zen, Japanese Zen, you may not find anybody. You might somebody, but it's just not likely because it's not part of their current tradition. In the Chinese Buddhism, it is there. I read a book on shamatha and vipassana in Chinese Buddhism. I must say I didn't find nearly the precision and sophistication that I found in Indo-Tibetan literature, but at least they were making that distinction. And in a marvelous movie, I keep on forgetting the title, but it's something like Amidst the Clouds, you remember it? You remember it? Amidst White Clouds, it's really quite extraordinary. And those are real yogis. They, namo, I have deep respect for them. Men and women in the heartland of China, really extraordinary yogis. Magnificent renunciation, utter simplicity, and since really pure ethics. Deep respect, only deep respect. Do they have a really good understanding of shamatha? Are they doing that distinctly? I don't know. I didn't have that impression. Does that mean they're not good yogis? No, it doesn't mean that at all. But are they achieving shamatha? Well, you won't achieve shamatha likely unless you try. You won't achieve it by practicing Mahamudra. You won't achieve it by doing a three-year retreat, because that's not part of the three-year retreat project. That's not saying three-year retreat is not useful, it's just that's not built in. At most, you may do 1 month of shamatha. If you achieve 1 month shamatha in 1 month, you get really a Nobel Prize, because that almost never happens. Right? And likewise, here in Southeast Asia, it's mostly vipassana. And then when people do allude to samatha, often, I must say, I just find their conceptual understanding inadequate. Sorry, I wish it were better news. But does that mean nobody's achieved it? No, I'm very certain people have. One of my teachers has, at least one, who's still alive, has definitely achieved it. At least one. Okay? But that's, I'm talking about my little pool. At least one of my teachers. So there we go. A person with poor faculties, but determination and persistence, how long? Person with medium faculties, how long? Is it simple curiosity? Is it encouraging, also joyful? And it's a perfectly good question, and it's pretty much impossible to answer. There's so many factors. Perfect good question. Okay. But to demystify it, then you can go to the classic, and we have such good literature now. From Tsongkhapa especially, I've never seen anything more definitive, precise, detailed, sophisticated, that in terms of just laying out the whole map. I've never seen anything better than Tsongkhapa. I've never seen anything to match Tsongkhapa in terms of his Lamrim Shamo, and I was one of the two translators for the Shamatha section, and his presentation in his medium Lamrim, I translated that one as well. I translated it out of reverence and faith, and it's magnificent. But you find also, Dujom Lingpa, it's not the same approach. They don't lay out all the nine stages and all of that, but the depth, the precision, the clarity is awe-inspiring. Dujom Lingpa, Karma Chame Rinpoche, Padmasambhava himself, the Sakya, all of the traditions have this. And so the teachings are there. There are still adepts of it. And if you look to the classic teachings rooted then in the Indian tradition, where there was, it was just much more frequent. You go back, 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, there were just more people achieving it. It seems to be a historical fact that you look, what are the outer conditions, what are the inner conditions? So it's really just kind of like, it's so prosaic. We should make this mundane and not think this is supernatural or mystical or waiting for blessings to come from some supernatural source. It's just pratityasamutpada. It's outer conditions, inner conditions. And if they're there, then you achieve shamatha. And if they're not, you don't. So Atisha, for example, said, if you have not fulfilled the prerequisites You can practice shamatha for 1,000 years and not achieve it. You might get some long life pill to live a love. That's 1,000 years of frustration because you won't achieve it if you don't have the outer and inner conditions. And so what I have certainly encountered a lot myself for 4 years that I devoted myself to practice. And of course, I've done a lot of practice, including extended retreats since then. But from 1980 to the end of 1983, the biggest problem I found was finding a suitable environment. And since the Shamatha Project, 5 years ago, I am leading now about 30, was like a dozen, then grew up, and then continued growing. As I've been attending to, watching over, caring for these people seeking to follow the path of Shamatha, the biggest problem has been environmental. Just right across the board. Not lust, not anger, not depression, not boredom, not lack of inspiration, not lack of renunciation. None of those. They come up, of course, they come up. But the one that's the biggest problem is, where's a conducive environment? Right? Really hard. That's why finally, Casa Tibet, Raida Bravo. So finally getting one. So, and that's why His Holiness is saying, hey, we need to actually create a place and not just say, oh, find a good cave in the Himalayas. You know, I found not quite a cave, but I found a little hut. It was okay. Bed bugs by the... Yeah, it sucks. 30 a night. Bed bugs. Have you ever been bitten by a bed bug? One is enough. Because one will strafe you. And they'll wake you up. Wow, does that itch? That's one. I would pull out of my bed bug, It felt like a bed bug. It was my sleeping bag. out of my bed bug nursery that I called my sleeping bag. For about the first 2 months of that retreat, 30 bed bugs every night. After a while, I kind of got the idea it was the same 30 bed bugs. Because I was a monk, I wouldn't kill them. So I just throw them outside. And my impression was, then during the daytime, they'd all scurry back in, and I think they enjoyed it. It was kind of like, whee! And then they're all getting in line for the, you know, for the next whee! And then meanwhile, they get a free lunch. So there it is. That was very romantic place and really awful. Bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, rats, no plumbing, and in the middle of the monsoon, you are living in a cloud and your clothes never get dry. Isn't it romantic? So that was one of the better places I meditated. So this is the thing with the outer and inner. The inner, you just read them. They're all over the place. But if you don't have those, you're not going to achieve shamatha. But the outer, well, we're moving in that direction, but the outer means not only a conducive environment that's quiet, that's clean, that's healthy. We have easy access to food. You don't have to worry about, and nowadays we say you don't have to worry about visa, et cetera, from the environment. But also one thing that now even among my own students, almost none of them have had, and it really would help a lot, is if they had something like 4 or 5 companions that they really felt like, as if they're sitting out on a sailing boat with a crew of 5 and say, look, we're all on the same boat here, we all want to go to the same place, and we're all here to help each other. Right? That is one of the not prerequisites. It's not absolutely indispensable, but it's really helpful. And especially if you're a relative novice. If you're like a Gelam Rinpoche, you've already been meditating 30 years or 15 years, you don't need that. You really don't need that at all, right? But if you're a relative novice, to be totally on your own, it's a bit tough, right? So at least that, if you can have some physical access to a teacher, that would be nice. But of course, in Tibet, they didn't have Skype. And frankly, I think Skype is probably good enough for access to a teacher. I mean, you know, we don't really need that much physical contact. I mean, a hug or a shake. The physical is not that important. But to be able to have, to visual, be nice, to see the teacher's face and have that kind of sense of live communication, that needs high, you know, broadband, high-speed internet. So that would be helpful. I think that's enough. But then have physical proximity with other fellow travelers. That'd be really good. And that's almost non-existent for the last 5 years for all my students. They're pretty much isolated. At most, they have 1 or 2 companions. That'd be really nice. So that's why, that's one of my major projects these days, is to try to do all I can, not being wealthy at all, but but help try and help people in Australia. Now there are about 30 people there in Australia who would like to get something going. Vida Brava in Mexico, they're already going. Brazil, really good prospects. And then India, now with His Holiness right there, wanting to see it happen. But that's a major thing. So when we see that, all the parts of the mandala have come together, that we really have a number of really conducive environments that are also inexpensive. You don't have to be rich to go into a 2 or 3 or 5 year retreat. That would be really nice. Because how many yogis do you know who are really rich? And so really modest. And so in other words, they're covered for food and utilities. And then all the better if we had something of a network so they can be communicating insofar it's helpful by Skyping or Internet, just to share data, share experiences. When that's in place, then I say, okay, now let your stopwatch start now. Now we have conducive environment. Now we have qualified practitioners. Now we have access to one or more qualified teachers. Okay, now let's say, okay, now it starts. Because now we have, let's assume they're qualified. Now we have all the outer and inner. And now we can start asking, okay, how are you doing? And in terms of sharp, medium, and dull faculties, how's it going? But until those come together, I think it's a perfectly good question, and I think it's a premature question. If we're talking about people in our modern world. Now, what's happening in Tibet? What's happening way back in Ladakh, in the hinterlands of Nepal and so forth? Don't know. But His Holiness will probably find out because he's going to try to recruit some of them for the center in Bangalore. What makes thoughts and images appear in the mind as if they come from nowhere? If the mind is not located anywhere, that is to say, not in the brain, what is the catalyst to trigger? Well, just for starters there, I see there is simply no evidence whatsoever that the mind is located in the brain. Something for which there's utterly conclusive evidence is that very specific activities in the brain are strongly correlated with very specific subjective experiences, mental events, states of consciousness. That's kind of beyond doubt, and for that we have to thank the neuroscientists. They're doing brilliant work. Correlations upon correlations, sometimes global, sometimes very local, sometimes right down to a single neuron. Quite amazing. And they'll apply a microelectrode to a single neuron and find that catalyzes a specific experience. That's quite interesting. Does that mean that specific experience is inside the neuron? There's no logic behind that at all. To say that two things are correlated, therefore they must be located in the same place. Exactly what logical system does that come from? Not any. Two things are correlated, that doesn't mean they're located in the same place at all. And there's no empirical evidence. You never see a thought inside a neuron. It is a categorical error. So, but to say that, all right, since we have no evidence that the mind is located in the brain, let's just not say that it is. And then just, but also, exactly where is justice located? In other words, does justice exist? Justice exist? It does on occasion, right? Where is it located? In the judge's brain? Or in the jury, or in the hammer, or in the courtroom, or in the media, or where does injustice occur? Well, justice and injustice, these are very important in our world, right? But since justice has no physical qualities, right? Then if it has no physical qualities, to locate it in physical space is probably a categorical error. Don't ask that question. It's a meaningless question. It's a wrong question. So likewise, to say, where is mind located? Well, if mind has some physical attributes, then good. We can say it's inside the brain or the heart or the liver or whatever. But if your mental events, states of consciousness and so forth, thoughts, images and so forth, have no physical attributes whatsoever, it doesn't make any sense to say where are they located in physical space any more than where is justice or where is righteousness, where is virtue. They don't have physical attributes, so don't even try to place them in a categorically wrong area. But now, can they correlate it? Well, if the mind is not located, what is the catalyst or trigger? Well, of course, brain activities can certainly be a catalyst or trigger. No question. How about alcohol? That's a chemical. Gets into your brain, and certain mental events start to arise. Right? That doesn't mean that dizziness or the silliness or the happiness or the depression, whatever, how you know, happy drunk, sad drunk. It doesn't mean those emotions or the sense of vertigo and so forth, are located inside the brain, but there's no question that brain activity can catalyze, or to use Buddhist terminology, alcohol in the brain, or a stroke in the brain, or other kind of drugs in the brain, and so forth, can these act as cooperative conditions for the emergence of specific mental events? The answer is yes, for sure, definitely. Do they transform into those mental events? There's no evidence for that whatsoever, right? So there we are. So cooperative conditions, this is the Buddhist analogy and the Buddhist analysis of, Buddhists don't talk about the brain a whole lot, but they certainly talk about the body, and that events in the body, including the prana system, serve as cooperative conditions that contribute to the emergence of mental events. Not substantial causes. They don't turn into mental events, but they are the cooperative conditions that enable the mental event to arise. And then we ask the question, or we can, all right, if a whole bunch of neural activity serving as a matrix of contributing circumstances or cooperative conditions, if they can catalyze, trigger, enable mental events to arise, are they enabling something to turn into nothing to turn into something, or are they catalyzing something to turn into something else? In other words, are they helping nothing turn into something, which would be magical, or are they catalyzing something to transform into something else, maybe similar, maybe dissimilar? The Buddhist view, of course, is you can never catalyze nothing to transform into something. Exactly how would you touch nothing to get it to budge? How would you bump it? How would you influence nothing? For nothing to say, what, you mean me? It really doesn't make any sense, does it? Or are thoughts nothing? Well, that's ridiculous. Thoughts has causal efficacy. We know that. Anybody who doesn't know that is not paying attention. And so it leaves open the question then. If brain activity, very specific, and again, we just listen to the neuroscientists to tell us, how is the brain operating? How is the brain contributing to the emergence of mental events? But then if you want to know from what do those mental events arise, don't ask the brain scientists because they don't have a clue. They really are just completely clueless and they don't even have a strategy for becoming clueful. They don't have any method to get a clue because they're only looking at cooperative conditions. And the stuff inside the brain just turns it into other formations of mass energy. All the chemicals and electricity in the brain just turned into other formations of chemicals and electricity. They never turn it into space-time, or they don't turn into information, and they don't turn into mental states either. Mass energy turns into mass energy. Conservation principle. Physics 101. So, but then, does this mean, oh, well then, nobody knows? No, people may know, but they'd have to look in the right place. And what might be a really good place to look if you're really wondering where do mental events arise from? You might want to look at the mental events and watch how they arise and watch what they arise from. And then you may find out. Just like astronomers observe how galaxies form by not thinking about them or looking at the brain states of astronomers. Actually look at the galaxies. It's a novel idea, but you know, I think it works. I've experienced seemingly random images, thoughts arise during meditation which are disturbing, and I'm wondering where they come from. It's a very interesting question. It's from Steph. There's Steph, yeah. It's a very interesting question, and I would be doing you a disservice if I gave you a totally satisfying answer. So I won't. Because if I give you a totally satisfying answer, then you might not ask that question any longer. And I would be doing you a disservice. And so it's a marvelous question. Let me give a bit of an answer as a working hypothesis that you actually could put to the test of experience. Because this is really interesting. This is really interesting. And we're not going to get any help from the psychologists because they're not trained to observe the mind. Oddly enough, psychologists are not trained professionally, with rare exceptions. They're not trained to observe minds, but to do questionnaires, and study behavior, and all that kind of stuff. And the brain scientists, they may as well be, you know, electrical engineers, for all we can learn from them. In fact, pretty much a lot of them are electrical engineers looking at EEG and so forth, generated by this biological computer. So, how about a hypothesis that one could put to the test? Where do they arise from? And why on occasion do they arise so stochastically, is a nice term from physics, just seemingly randomly? Like, what catalyzed that? and you're looking for the factors of origination, like, okay, where's some coherent, reasonable, oh yes, independent upon that, this arose, and you're coming up with nothing. Like, I'm just sitting here and... Long time ago, I was teaching shamatha. Long time ago, 1976. And I was encouraging people, focus on Buddha image. Buddha image. You know, good Gulopa monk. So people... having a hard time. One guy said, I can't visualize it all. I sat there for the whole session, nothing, no images whatsoever, except right towards the end of the session, I had an image of a seagull. Why a seagull? Why not at least a dakini? You know, something a little bit Buddha-ish, rather than just, you know, a seagull. So, quite mysterious. Okay, so... There's a deeper level question, you know, why, are there any reasons? I mean, quantum mechanics, it said if you have some uranium, it will eject photons for no reason at all. That is, if you find a specific photon and you say, what exactly catalyzed that, the emission of that photon at that time, then not all, but many quantum physicists will say, it just happened. Right? Yeah. Just happened. And why would they say that? Because with all the incredible sophistication of their measuring systems, they cannot measure anything that occurred just prior to that that could account for the trigger, that would provide a trigger for that particular photon emission. Statistically, they can talk about the half-life of uranium and say how long will it be before a certain quantity of photons, you know, have been emitted. That they can do statistically. But one by one, they can't measure. They looked, and they can't find anything. So they say, okay, it's stochastic. It just, go figure, it just happens. In other words, causality, strict causality, independent upon this occurred, doesn't occur right down to the elementary particle level. There's a point which you have to say, it just happens. Now, is that the final word? Well, what if there are non-physical, and this is a question, not an answer. I'm not pretending like, oh yeah, I got the answer. I don't. But what if there were non-physical influences on that chunk of uranium? If they're non-physical, the physicists won't be able to measure it. Are there any non-physical influences in the natural universe? Of course there are. And we know that, not to say that that's necessarily the case here, I don't know, but we've already run the experiment. Remember how, Chitra, remember her nodding? That was information that catalyzed her nodding. It wasn't just after some time she went, for no reason at all, you know, because I didn't stretch her mouth or anything. She didn't have, you know, it was clearly there was a cause and effect there. I said, you know, blah, blah, and then she nodded and smiled. But what catalyzed that? And again, it wasn't sound waves. It wasn't something physical. Did something physical come from my mouth? Yeah, it's called sound waves. But blah, 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 that's sound waves too. So it was information that catalyzed that. But information is not physical. Now, could it be information that catalyzes uranium? I don't know. But at least we should be aware that there is causality in the physical universe that is not physical. We should acknowledge that. It's true. So now here we come here. Now, short answer, it's almost 6. But this is really worth returning to. And we will, especially in 2 weeks when we go to the mind. Okay? Buddhist answer. That domain of the mind. We have 6 domains. The domain of mind in which thoughts, images arise. When you just start looking at it, when I say next week, latter part of next week, attend to the space of the mind, whatever arises within it, you're attending to what called, among the 18 dhatus, 18 domains, 18 elements, you're attending to the domain of mental events, the domain of that which you can cognize by way of mental consciousness. Okay, that which you can apprehend or know by way of mental consciousness. That's called dharma dhatu, relative level, conventional level, not ultimate reality. So we're going to say, okay, those thoughts are arising within Dharma Dhatu. They're emerging from Dharma Dhatu. Okay? Now, one of the most interesting, and to my mind, provocative and compelling accounts I've seen of all of this, comes from Dzogchen. I started in Abhidhamma. That's good baseline. So I like to go back and forth from the foundational Buddhism right up to what I believe is, in fact, the pinnacle. Dzogchen. And Dzogchen, this is directly from Drichul Nyingma, he said, all of the appearances, just for starters, let's say all the appearances of thoughts and images, including dreams when you're asleep. All those images, thoughts, the noises you hear in the dreams, and maybe you're eating some jello, and the taste of jello in the dream. All of those, where are all of the appearances arising from? And the answer is they're arising from the alaya, the substrate. The substrate. And the substrate is that space of the mind that is apprehended by alaya vijnana, substrate consciousness. In other words, when your coarse mind has dissolved, when it's gone dormant, like when you've achieved shamatha, right? Coarse mind is dissolved. Your woman's mind, your background, person history, all of that, gone dormant. And it's dissolved into substrate consciousness. What are you aware of? That space. And it's called the alaya. So it's consciousness of the alaya, therefore alaya vijnana. Vijnana means consciousness, right? So Dujin Lingbo, he's speaking for the whole Dzogchen tradition here, that all mental appearances, whether the dream appearances in the waking state, memories, thoughts, images, and so forth, they're all appearing from and then eventually dissolving back into alaya, space of mind. Space of mind. They're illuminated by alaya vijnana, substrate consciousness. But they're emerging from alaya. And then he goes on even more interestingly and says, this is true not only of mental events, thoughts, discursive thoughts, mental images, but all these appearances. When you wake up from deep sleep, you wake up from deep sleep. In deep sleep, your mind has dissolved into substrate consciousness, and all appearances to your mind have dissolved into alaya. Right? So imagine you're really zoned out, stage 4, non-REM, deep sleep, and then somebody, for whatever reason, jostles you, and you come right from deep, dreamless sleep, and then suddenly, what? And, of course, your awareness is being flooded by a whole bunch of appearances, the visual, the auditory, your tactile. Maybe there's even fragrances and tastes, who knows? And then thoughts will arise. Why? Why did you wake me up? Why? And so images coming to mind as well. All of those appearances, by way of all the six sense doors, all the five sensory and the mental, all of those appearances, bar none, are emerging from the substrate. So in other words, the colors, when I gaze at Anila's upper robe there, the zen, the color that I see, the burgundy that I see, the color that I see, the philosophers call it the qualia, okay? The colors that I see, the colors are not being sprayed from her zen. The photons are not red. No part of my visual cortex turns red, right? The colors that I see, not her zen. Her zen is made of fabric, and it was made someplace, and that her zen does not exist in my substrate. Her zen, the shawl there, is physical. It exists in physical space and not in my substrate. But the color that I see when I direct my attention to that, the color that I see is not there intrinsically in the fabric, not in the photons, not inside my brain. The color that I see is in, it's present in the alaya. And so that's for visual, it's for sounds, taste, all of it, all appearances. They're all arising from, when I wake up and say, what, and suddenly I'm getting appearances maybe in all six senses, if I have something in my mouth and I can smell something. All those appearances are arising from alaya. And then, let's imagine I'm a real fast sleeper, and somebody says, oh, I'm sorry I woke you. You can go back to sleep now. And I say, okay. And then, like a black hole, all those appearances dissolve right back into my substrate. They're not waiting for me, and they don't dissolve someplace else. They arose from my substrate, because after all, I'm viewing from my perspective. And those appearances, of course, are arising independent upon brain activity. No question. And damage the brain activity, and some of those appearances won't arise, or they'll be altered, and so forth. But where are they coming from? They're coming from alaya, which then, and now at 6:01, I'm going to wrap up quickly, but we'll return to this. It's so interesting. I find it absolutely fascinating. And especially, just as a parallel, poetic perhaps, maybe it's more, I don't know, but at least a poetic parallel, is my thesis when I did my undergraduate work in physics, was on the zero-point energy of the electromagnetic vacuum, which is to say, the energy of an empty space. You take a volume of space and now theoretically, take out all matter and all energy, even gravitational energy, which you can't do in practice. But imagine as a thought experiment that you have a volume of space and you take out all matter, right down to elementary particle, zero elementary particles, right? And then take out thermal energy, electromagnetic energy, gravitational energy, to take out all energy out of it, to suck it out. So now you have, that's just space with nothing else to it. And then a question has been posed. It comes most explicitly in something called quantum field theory. Is there any energy in the nature of space itself? Does space have its own energy prior to all the add-ons of electromagnetic energy, gravitational, thermal, and so forth? Does space have its own energy right built into the very nature of space? And the answer is yes. And it's not just a theoretical supposition. Actually, there's empirical evidence for it. And it was the empirical confirmation of something called the Casimir effect. And so I studied that. I actually wrote to Mr. Casimir. He wrote back. It was very kind of him. So, but this gets fascinating, that space itself has its own energy built in. It's not added on. It's right in the nature of space. Now you get to quantum field theory, which is the union of quantum mechanics and special relativity theory. Brilliant, brilliant work by Paul Dirac about 80 years ago. Yep. And then you get this statement, that all configurations of mass energy are actually emerging from empty space. All of them are nothing other than configurations of space and its energy. So whether it's true or not, there's a thought by some very brilliant physicists, and they have some empirical evidence behind it. So now let us consider that the space, the alaya, the space of the mind, is not just a vacuity, not just a totally absolute void, which it's clearly not. Let's imagine that that space, that alaya, is actually saturated by energy. Not physical energy, another kind of energy. And that energy, which by itself is formless, shapeless, doesn't look like anything, but when catalyzed, takes on form, like a magician, takes on form. But then the form dissolves right back into it. So science fiction-wise, a holodeck, like in what was Star Trek. Empty, but then turn it on and then suddenly you get, or holographic images. That's not Star Trek. There it is, it's empty, and then suddenly you're having these three-dimensional forms pop out of seemingly nothing. Well, they're not popping out of nothing, they're coming out of energy, right? And so consider that the alaya is a space, but it's suffused by a type of energy. Puttick, to be sure, it's not physical energy, not something physicists know anything about. But that would suggest that these images and thoughts and so forth are actually configurations of, emerging from, the energy of the space of the mind. And then when they vanish, they dissolve right back into that empty space. But that space is pregnant. It's a plenum. And it's just ready to burst forth. So the place you can observe this most directly and fascinatingly is, and it's not impossible, it takes a bit of work, is to become lucid in dreamless sleep, where you're just resting in substrate consciousness and all you're aware of is the substrate. Okay? And be lucid. Know that you're doing that while you're doing it. And then, what's the genesis of a dream? And watch the dreamscape. Then watch it. Don't philosophize about it. Don't speculate about it. Watch the dreamscape, the dream environment, emerge from that substrate. And then when the dream comes to an end, watch where it dissolves into. Oh yeah. That's part one. There's more to come. Enjoy your evening. See you tomorrow morning.